I want you to imagine now that you have a brain tumour. And one day you wake up, your head is throbbing, there's hemorrhaging in your eye. You call an ambulance, but when it arrives, the paramedics start asking if you've been drinking or taking drugs. This is a real-life story about an Indigenous woman. And in Life Matters, we're looking into this and other case studies as part of RN's focus this week on institutional racism towards Indigenous people in our health system. To extend the discussion, I'm joined by Romley Mokak, the CEO of the Lowitcher Institute for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Health Research, Dr. Paul Lawton, who's a kidney specialist who's worked as a clinician across the Northern Territory. He's also a research fellow at the Menzies School of Health Research, and Jill Gallagher, the CEO of the Victorian Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisation. This is the peak body representing Aboriginal-run health organisations in Victoria. Romley Mokak, when it comes to racism within the health sector, in summary, what are some of the ways that Indigenous people can face barriers or maltreatment?
Thanks, Amanda. I think the thing to think about in the first is that racism or race-based discrimination results in avoidable and unfair inequalities across groups. So there's this issue of not only the racism, but the results of racism. Some of these things can be very overt, brutally overt in terms of, you know, physical abuse, verbal abuse. This is in the broad. But other things are more insidious and more subtle. Things like exclusion, the ignoring of Aboriginal people. And that was a case in point, that case study that you mentioned, ignoring Aboriginal people's voices and their very perspectives, silencing Aboriginal matters within governance structures and the ways in which health services work. So the main point, I think, to make, and we know that the question of racism sits very squarely in the national debate right now. There's no denying that it exists, and it exists in the health system.
Jill, can you tell me about any of your own family members' experiences with hospitals where you feel assumptions were made because they're Indigenous?
Yes. Hello, Amanda. I can. I know of a real-life case study where an Aboriginal man, for many years he lived in Melbourne, and he was actually my blood uncle, and he was undiagnosed Huntington's disease, which is a very severe chronic illness. And because the health system just saw him as a black man, an Aboriginal man, they had this view that he was intoxicated all the time he presented at hospitals. So they just treated him quite blasé and sent him on his way. It wasn't until he broke his hip due to his illness that, and I was in the emergency with him, when I realised that the doctors weren't taking him serious, and they basically put it down that he was intoxicated. And I advised them that he's not. He was not. He had not had a drink. It was early in the morning, because they asked him what did he have for breakfast. And he basically said, I had Wheaties. But because of his illness, his language was slurred. So they just assumed he said whiskey, and therefore they assumed he was drunk.
Right, so whiskey instead of Wheaties, wow.
Yeah, it's just, but it was that view that, you know, and he was diagnosed very late in his illness, where he could hardly walk, hence him breaking his hip.
Yeah. Now, Paul Lawton in Darwin, when you're working with Indigenous patients, have you observed firsthand any of this sort of behaviour by colleagues, or, you know, making perhaps incorrect assumptions? Maybe you've done this yourself in the past.
Well, hello, Amanda, and thanks for having me. This issue is pervasive right across Australia. Have I observed it? Yes, I have. I'm on the record about one of my patients, Gurumul Yunupingu, who was assumed because he had liver disease to have been an alcoholic, even though his liver disease was not necessarily due to alcohol at all, last year when he presented very unwell to the Royal Darwin Hospital. Not only that, but we see quite a number of other cases. But more importantly to me, because all of these cases can be explained away and have been explained away by hospital bureaucracy as, you know, isolated cases or misunderstanding or something that just happened through a miscommunication of some sort that was not ill-intentioned or otherwise a problem. But we know that national data shows that there is systemic bias against Indigenous people in the hospital system. We know that Indigenous patients compared to exactly the same non-Indigenous patients are 2/3 as likely to get a procedure for the same diagnosis. We know that Indigenous people are 7.8 times more likely to discharge against medical advice than non-Indigenous patients. And that's as high as 10 times where I come from in the Northern Territory.
Well, as part of RN's wider focus on this subject, Background Briefing and also our podcast This Is About are also both considering institutional racism in the Australian hospital system this week. This Is About tells the story of Colleen Lavelle. She's a Waka Waka woman, originally from Hervey Bay, and she now lives in Brisbane to be closer to medical services because she has a brain tumour. Now, as an Aboriginal woman, Colleen says she's experienced racism her whole life. But she says those previous experiences were nothing compared to when she got sick. Here's Colleen describing what happened to her when she called an ambulance after waking up one morning with blood in her eye and a bad headache.
The paramedic who was in the back with me then proceeded to ask, do I smoke yandi? Do I smoke marijuana? And I'm like, no. And then she's like, you can admit to me, you know, you can get a hemorrhage quite easy in the eye from too much yandi. And I'm like, no, I don't smoke it. And then she was talking about, was I drinking? Was I partying? You might have had a few too many last night. And I'm like, no, this is my brain tumour. And so we eventually get up to the hospital and we're sitting in emergency, like I wasn't even still. I wasn't on a gurney or anything. It was just walk me in, sit me out, and we were waiting for hours. It was like 4 hours or something. But I was watching people coming in, being called, coming out, leaving. My son had gone up quite a few times up to the triage counter to say, we're still here, to have them saying, yes, it's, you know, priority, you know, some people need to be seen ahead of others, which I understand. But in this time, the hemorrhage hadn't just built up so that I was just seeing red. It was actually at the point where there was blood sort of seeping out. No one even worried too much. No one even came over to check on me, to see if I was all right, to see if I needed pain relief. When I finally got to see the doctor, he just sort of freaked out and went, hang on, why were you waiting so long? Your eye's bleeding. Like, well, no shit, Sherlock. So I actually had to be rushed off then to surgery to ease the pressure. But it's like the whole idea of how you're seen, it does affect the care you get and how you are treated in a hospital.
Colleen Lavelle, and you can hear the rest of her story on the RN podcast This Is About. Now, Dr. Paul Lawton, this sort of thing also extends beyond emergency wards, doesn't it? For instance, I think you've done research that shows that Indigenous people are far less likely to get a kidney transplant. Tell us more about that.
Yes, I'm a kidney specialist and my work is mainly with Indigenous people, so I'm very interested in this topic. Kidney disease affects Indigenous people much more frequently than non-Indigenous people for a variety of reasons, none of which are related to alcohol, by the way. And when they get kidney disease, the problem is that there are two treatments. One is a dialysis therapy with machines to clean the rubbish from the blood, and they are often needed. They actually lead to lots of social dislocation, particularly for people from remote areas. And a much more effective treatment we know is a kidney transplant. It allows people to live their lives more normally and indeed perhaps to go home to a remote area. But Indigenous people are remote areas are a tenth as likely as a non-Indigenous person from the same area to get a kidney transplant. And indeed, if we look at major capital cities like Sydney or Melbourne, Indigenous people are a third as likely to get a kidney transplant as a person from the same area who has the same illness, who is the same age, who is the same gender and is otherwise the same.
Well, Romley Mokak, in RN's latest background briefing, that program focuses on how Katherine Hospital in the Northern Territory was once not a good place for Indigenous people to be treated. But in the past 5 years, it's been very successful at turning things around. What can other hospitals learn from Katherine?
I think the important thing that I took from that Katherine case study, if you like, was the importance of leadership at the institutional level. So new CEO, new doctors, and some new ways of thinking about how to engage properly with Aboriginal people. So the relationship between patients and their healthcare providers is so critical to the outcomes that we might see. And so The National Health Plan itself, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Health Plan, speaks directly to that vision in the health system of being free of racism. But that has got to connect quite specifically to Aboriginal people's knowledges, cultures, circumstances, the things that are important in their lives. And I think that Katherine case study, in putting Aboriginal people's perspectives centre to the well-being context made the difference. And I think Paul's mentioned, the discharge against medical advice, which is language and terminology that puts the blame often on the person who is leaving the hospital setting. But the reduction in those who, of their own volition, kind of walked out of the hospital system. The reduction in those rates is a measure, and Katherine has done well. There are lessons to be learned across the country, but this isn't just a matter of hospitals. It's about the whole chain, the whole journey of an individual and their kin, their family, in accessing those larger hospitals or tertiary centres from wherever they might be.
This is Life Matters. I'm Amanda Smith with Romley Mokak, the CEO of the Lowitcher Institute, also Dr. Paul Lawton, a kidney specialist in Darwin, and Jill Gallagher, the CEO of the Victorian Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisation. Well, one of the things that the Background Briefing program highlights, as Romley and Paul have both mentioned too, is that communication between staff and patients can break down because of language barriers, and previously lots of patients at Katherine Hospital would just leave before they were really well enough to. In 2011, Katherine Hospital's take-own leave rates were the highest in the country. Now they're one of the lowest. So here's an excerpt from Background Briefing's Teresa Heidel, the Aboriginal liaison officer at Katherine Hospital, and she's talking about the language and cultural discrepancies at play.
I do explain how long they'll probably need to be taking that medication, you know, or if that's your medication, if you stop taking that, you'll be finished soon. Yeah. And a lot of them don't have that big understanding for medications, doctors' words. They don't. We've got to break it down as simple as we can. And if we can't break it down simple, we have to get an interpreter come in and break it down. And it's like the word cancer. There's not an Aboriginal word that means cancer. So how do you explain those things to them? Yeah, sometimes it's better getting an interpreter and they'll think of ways around it. Yeah, I remember one day a lady had this fungus, and there's no word for those things on women's bodies or inside. So I heard the interpreter tell her, you know, like mushrooms growing? They got her to stay, but yeah, to get treated.
Teresa Heidel, the Aboriginal Liaison Officer at Katherine Hospital. Now, Jill Gallagher, tell me, what are some of the historical factors for why some Indigenous people may not feel safe in hospitals?
Amanda, I think some of the historical factors, things like, you know, in some hospitals, I won't name them or shame them, but in some hospitals throughout Victoria, Aboriginal women weren't allowed in the main wards. If they wanted to give birth, they had to birth on verandas. Just the attitude that people had towards Aboriginal people presenting at hospitals. So the historical, and it's in living memory of our people today. I mean, Vic Health a couple of years ago did some very good research in three LGAs in rural Victoria. And one of the results of that research, that 98% of Aboriginal people in those local government areas experienced racism. The Victorian State Government released in 2014 a report around racism in Victoria. And it dealt with the impacts of racism and it dealt with Aboriginal communities also. It was horrific, you know. I mean, racism just doesn't impact on your physical health. It actually impacts on your mental health.
Yes.
And in the Aboriginal community-controlled health system today, a lot of our people who are presenting at our organisations is for mental health. That's one of the biggest, as a result, I believe, as a result of racism.
Romley Mokak, the Lowitja Institute has developed something called a kind of roadmap for Indigenous patients called Managing Two Worlds Together. Now, as I understand it, it aims to smooth the way for those travelling from remote communities for treatment. How does the roadmap help?
Well, that's right, Amanda. So the Lowitja Institute funded a piece of work undertaken by Flinders University in collaboration with a number of Aboriginal medical services. The Managing Two Worlds Together project and stage three of that project is a workbook. So it's a tool, something that can help Aboriginal people and practitioners and service providers really uncover this complexity. So we talked earlier about what made a difference in Katherine. And it's not just the person presenting to the hospital, but that person, if we think about the rhetoric that sits around client-centred or patient-centred care, and there's a lot of that in policy in this country, what we're trying to do here through this tool is to actually really articulate that, bring it to the fore. So this is about all of those who might be along that journey with that patient and their family, have putting their perspectives into the map. So these are things that are really critical, like and actually drawing it out and working out, you know, if to get from Armitage in the north of South Australia to Adelaide for a specialist sort of surgery, what are the things, what does that journey look like, and where are the things, the points where things might go wrong? How do people actually transport themselves? Is there a carer that's going with them? Can they speak English as a first language? Where are the or second or third language? Where are the interpreter services? These are all of the inbuilt institutionalised and systemic racism elements that we're trying to tackle. The capacity to go wrong and to really have very bad consequences is drawn out through this exercise.
Mm. Let's hear now from George Newhouse, a human rights lawyer and professor of law at Macquarie University. At the moment, he's representing a number of Indigenous clients across Australia, including in New South Wales, whose family members have died in the hospital system. And in these cases, there are concerns on the part of families that the patient's Aboriginality may have been a factor in the type of treatment they received. Here's a voice memo from George Newhouse discussing one case involving a young woman.
In the early hours of the 1st of January 2016, a 27-year-old Aboriginal woman, about 26 weeks pregnant, we'll call her Naomi for cultural reasons, went to the emergency department of Tumut Hospital. She was sick with septicemia. Instead of keeping her in emergency for observations, Naomi was discharged a short time later after being given a paracetamol tablet and no other treatment. When she woke up at home later that morning, Naomi complained to her partner that she was struggling to breathe and unable to walk properly. Her partner called one of Naomi's family members and asked them to drive her to the hospital. When the family member arrived, Naomi had rapidly worsened and an ambulance was called. She died en route to Tumut Hospital. An autopsy found that Naomi had died of meningococcal virus and septicemia, a dangerous blood infection. Naomi's mum says that she attended the hospital several times in the year before she died, including before her pregnancy, suffering from severe stomach pains. Each time she was given an IV drip and sent home.
That's lawyer George Newhouse, who's acting on behalf of Naomi's family. And he goes on to say that the family has complained about racism, in the months before Naomi's death, and they believe that their concerns weren't acted upon. George Newhouse has asked the New South Wales coroner to look into Naomi's death, and he tells us they're considering that request. A spokesperson representing Tumut Hospital has previously said that all hospital procedures were followed during Naomi's treatment. The hospital has also implemented Aboriginal cultural awareness training following Naomi's death. And it's worth noting that on one of the occasions that Naomi presented at Tumut Hospital, she was referred to drug and alcohol counsellors, but her mother says she didn't have any of these problems. Paul Lawton, is part of the problem here that nobody thinks they're racist? You know, what can be done to help health professionals working in this space think about their responses?
One of the useful ideas that has come out of the United States of America is the concept of unconscious bias in the last 15 years or so. And this, there's a significant body of research, again, mainly in the US, that tells us that people who are under situations of stress with limited time and the need to actually make certain assumptions to actually get the job done, make those assumptions, and often those assumptions are wrong. And we're all like that under situations of stress. And the emergency department is a classic illustration of that environment. Senior emergency department doctors have actually told me that that's actually necessary to get the job done. The important thing is not that assumptions are made initially, but that those assumptions need to be questioned when the first few minutes of the emergency are being, after the first few minutes of the emergency have been managed. Now, the good news is that we can combat unconscious biases amongst people who, and these are biases or illustrations of racist behaviour where people are not necessarily meaning to be racist. There are individualised strategies to, we call them de-biasing strategies, that can we can teach people to actually think through their logic when they actually are able to, after those first few minutes of the initial assumption. We can, and Romley's pointed to this, also engage in de-biasing strategies at an organisational level. And these are probably more important, as Romley's alluded to, because when you have unconscious biases, when you say, well, I'm not a racist, that was just a mistake. I just thought about this problem in the heat of the moment and sent the lady home, and it's a terrible misunderstanding. What we need when there is unconscious bias is systemic responses, responses at the organisational level. And it's interesting to hear in George's story of that unfortunate young woman that Tumut Hospital introduced cultural awareness training after the event occurred.
At least they did that, though. That's very true. Dr. Paul Lawton is a kidney specialist working as a clinician across the Northern Territory and a research fellow at the Menzies School of Health Research. Romley Mokak is the CEO of the Lowitja Institute for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Health Research. And Jill Gallagher is the CEO of the Victorian Aboriginal Community Controlled Health Organisation. Thanks so much to you all for joining us and taking us through some of these issues. And you can listen to the background briefing program about Katherine Hospital via the RN website or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can also find the RN podcast This Is About the same way. And if you felt discriminated against by the health system, I'd be interested to hear from you. You can email lifematters@abc.net.au. You're listening to Life Matters with Amanda Smith.